This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com welcoming you back to Economics 101. Today I'm honored to be joined on the line by Peter Dale Scott, famed Canadian poet and political commentator. He is a retired professor from the University of California at Berkeley, and his voluminous writings include Drugs, Oil, and War, and The Road to 9/11. Peter Dale Scott, thank you very much for joining me today on the program.
Well, I'm very glad to be with you.
Well, I wanted to draw on your extensive research in the field of deep politics and the deep state to find out what your research has indicated about the topic of drug money and Wall Street and the connections between the two. And I know that you've done quite a lot of research on the deep state and drug money and drug laundering. So what can you tell us about the possible connections on that front?
Well, there are some areas where I have the ability to get information that other people have not seen. With the question of banks, there is so much secrecy about banking that I'm pretty much limited to what the media have told us. But it's clear that the drug trafficking is a major factor in the world scheme, and some people put it up as maybe number three, after with oil being the number one, and then arms number two, and then drugs number three. Actually, there's a certain amount of interaction between those, because very often where you're having illicit trafficking of arms, the planes that take arms in one direction, the arms are paid for with drugs and the planes come back with drugs, and there's quite a lot of that. One of the hard pieces of information recently was the UNODC, that's their Office of Drugs and Crime. The head of it said that he knew for a certainty that in this recent financial crisis, there were certain banks which only survived because they had access to hot money to be laundered from the drug traffic, and that this had kept banks afloat. Another source, hard source we have, is a Senate study done for the U.S. Senate some years ago, which indicated that something like $500 billion was being laundered through the top U.S. banks every year. Not all of that was drug money, but a significant percentage of it was. And the scandal here is that some of the names named in this study are the top U.S. banks, like Citibank. Well, it's known that Citibank has maintained a private bank where they've received funds from people like the brother of the president of Mexico, for example, which funds vastly in excess of what he could possibly have earned from his salary. Yet the only bank really that has suffered as a result of this, and it was, I think, a slap on the wrist, was UBS, which is a Swiss bank. And there are many ironies about that story. They were consciously laundering funds from a drug trafficker right in Boston. And they paid $400,000, I think, in fines, which was only a small percentage of what they had earned by doing this, so it was hardly a disincentive. And the only person who went to jail was the whistleblower, who, in a spirit of public-mindedness, had gone to the U.S. government with the facts of the story, and he was prosecuted for having violated the secrecy which is supposed to surround banking. It's very hard, you know. Obviously, banks have to be secret in some respect, but there is a major tension between the secrecy that surrounds banking and the notion of an open society.
Well, that's right, and we can hope for more transparency and for more protections for whistleblowers, like in the UBS case, but I guess a lot of people who are analysts and commentators are not holding out much hope for a great deal of reform on that front. But looking back historically for more examples of this type of connection, BCCI is a bank that's often held out in this regard, in this with the connection of drug money laundering. Can you tell people a little bit about the history of that bank and what it was involved in?
Well, BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, had its beginnings as a Pakistani bank, but I don't think it would have spread throughout the world the way it did if it had not established a relationship with the CIA early on. The CIA relationship began with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December 1979. And the CIA didn't have many resources in that part of the world and relied to ship its equipment on Gokal Shipping, which was owned by the same people as BCCI. It was virtually an extension of the BCCI empire. And the financial negotiations for the shipment of arms to that part of the world were handled through BCCI. And because it was being handled through Pakistan's ISI, their intelligence, it's military intelligence, but it's the equivalent of the CIA in that country. Pakistan had very special motives in Afghanistan. They were not interested, really, in a fully independent Afghanistan, because Afghanistan shares a border with Pakistan, which is in dispute, the so-called Durand Line, which divides Pashtun tribes and even families. And the ISI were looking for people in Afghanistan to give the money to who would not contest that line. And this meant that the authentic freedom fighters in Afghanistan were largely bypassed in favor of two major recipients for CIA aid. One, Gulbedin Hekmatyar, was thoroughly under control by Pakistan, and another one, Abdul Razul Sayaf, was a client of Saudi Arabia. Now, because these two recipients had nothing like the same kind of popular base in Afghanistan that the other freedom fighters did, they relied instead on the drug traffic. And this is where we come back to BCCI, because BCCI, from the very beginning, handled the drug trafficking for these clients in Afghanistan. And according to some sources, were even involved in the whole question of arms into Pakistan, drugs coming back out, financing in both directions, that all of this was something in which BCCI was heavily involved, very much at the center, because of its special privileged status with the ISI. And very quickly, that became a privileged relationship with William Casey, the head of the CIA. Now, of course, eventually there were scandals involving BCCI and drugs, particularly in the United States. And the investigation of these scandals led eventually to a Senate investigation on CIA involvement with BCCI, and the CIA said, well, we've looked in our records, we can't find any records. And the Senate inquiry that looked into this deduced that possibly this was true, and that there's no question that William Casey from time to time would see the head of BCCI in Washington. But he did so as a private individual. That is to say, Casey was not only the head of the CIA, but he was also, enjoyed another title as the personal representative of the president on intelligence matters. Under wearing one hat or another, it became common for Casey to go over to meet Abedi, the head of BCCI, in a hotel room. with maybe one or two staff people, and very probably no records were kept, but very, very important decisions were made. I think one of these decisions, which is still haunting us, was the decision to recruit Muslims from other countries to serve as a kind of foreign legion in Afghanistan. These are the so-called Arab Afghans. They weren't Afghans, and all of them weren't, in fact, Arabs. And a lot of them were recruited inside the United States. And I think Casey was particularly interested in that because his motive in fighting in Afghanistan was at least partly to inflict maximum damage on the Soviet Union. And these Arab Afghans were recruited for, and also particularly the troops underneath Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Abdul Razzaq Sayaf were recruited to actually go into the Soviet Union itself and conduct terrorist raids in the Soviet Union. Now, at the risk of oversimplifying slightly, those terrorists in the 1980s who were attacking the Soviet Union are the ancestors of what became Al-Qaeda, who have since then continued to fight in the areas of the former Soviet Union and also notoriously in the case of 9/11 now, allegedly at any rate, inside the United States as well.
Well, that's exactly right. And we see from that the ramifications that these types of backdoor deals have and how corrosive that really is to our society when these types of deals are being done in private. And it raises the question more generally, I think, of the connection between the deep state and the financial sector or the banking industry in general. What can you say about that larger connection?
Well, before we leave what I was talking about, I think because these were off-the-books operations which could not be sent to Reagan for approval, they tended to be operations which were financed by drugs. So it's not a coincidence that the people who are involved in the terrorist operations of the 1980s are the people whose operations are being financed by drugs. I don't talk much about the deep state anymore because people tend to visualize it as some kind of hard-edged thing, but I will continue to talk about deep politics and all of these things which don't get written down, which we know go on, and which repeatedly involve the interaction between authorized purveyors of violence, by which I mean the state, and other sources of violence which are not authorized, by which I mean the underworld, or the world of organized crime and the international world of drug trafficking. That is a great deal of politics is deep, but the deep politics I'm talking about is this use of violence, where the state will work with people who are not actually officially authorized to use violence, but it goes on in a big way anyway. And the drug traffic use of terrorists in the Soviet Union in the 1980s would be one example of that. But I say that the history of this kind of thing goes back deep into American politics because for those of us who live in the United States, it's well known that in countries like Chicago or New Orleans or New York in the era of Tammany, which is some years back now, local politics and local organized crime were intimately involved, and the gangs of toughs who would go out and establish phony unions in an industry for the sake of the employers were the same gangs of toughs who would ensure that a neighborhood voted for one party or another party.
So in this in the connection, of course, we see this continuing today with what's happening in Afghanistan today. And it, of course, recently it was revealed the connection between the CIA and Hamid Karzai's brother. And we see the types of drug connections continuing with the intelligence agencies. Can you talk a little bit more about how this is all continuing up to the present day?
Yes, well, what's happening in Afghanistan today with where drugs is sort of at the heart of the economy and is financing, you know, the American press keeps saying that it's financing the Taliban. Well, it may be, but it's also financing the warlords who are supporting the Karzai government. And it's really very much a rerun of what happened earlier in Laos and Vietnam. In fact, this irony that the president's brother is simultaneously a CIA agent and also a drug trafficker, this is an exact rerun of Vietnam in the Ngo Dinh Diem era, when Ngo Dinh Nu, the brother, was the, again, you know, here were two people who didn't have much popular base, and Ngo Dinh Nu reinforced his power by turning to the drug traffic. I can't speak with authority about what turned Karzai's brother to the drug traffic, but I suspect that it was the same thing, not purely the desire for financial gain, although that would certainly be part of it, but you don't have a popular base, and so you the drug traffic is a way of building up cadres of organized gangs who are a substitute for popular power. And America is very limited, you know, and I don't know if America will ever realize that it just cannot be a winning game to go into a strange country where your only asset to winning hearts and minds is money, because when you try that, as they did in Vietnam, as they did in Laos, the result inevitably is massive corruption. Something like a quarter of the Afghan budget now, I believe, is in the form of bribes, that what people pay to the government so that their poppy fields won't be destroyed or so that they can do business with the local people. It's massive corruption. This alienates the people. I think it's safe to say, I would say, that people who know Afghanistan, I don't put myself in that number, I just read the works of people who do, are pretty unanimous that what America is trying to do here is not going to succeed. I mean, not the stated aims, which are to, you know, install a stable government in Kabul, are wildly remote and come from a failure to recognize that Afghanistan is not a state in the sense that countries of Western Europe are states. It's an area of a lot of tribes that have, and it's an area that has been relatively peaceful when the tribes simply accept each other's authority in their areas, and which has seen disasters when people have tried to come down heavily from the center, as the Russians did, or as the British famously tried back in the early 19th century and lost an entire army.
Well, certainly this is a huge problem and one that's been ongoing for decades, and we're unlikely to untangle all of the knots here today. So if people are more interested in following up on this type of topic, what one of your works would you recommend people turn to the most?
Well, I think my most authoritative study of what's gone wrong in American politics because of the influence of deep politics and particularly shenanigans involving the CIA, I think that's probably my book, The Road to 9/11. That's probably primarily for people who really want a close-up knowledge of American politics. If they're more interested in the international drug traffic and why it is tolerated by the CIA to the extent it is, I would recommend Drugs, Oil, and War, where I try to explain why it is that the countries where the drug traffic is being built up have all been in areas of major interest to the big U.S. international oil companies. And I will have a book coming out in the fall with the provisional title, The Road to Afghanistan, which looks at the same story in a more historical perspective, going back to World War II. There I'm talking about what I call deep history, the whole history of the relationship of the CIA to the drug traffic is deep, in the sense that it's not part of the official CIA history, or even the tolerated, officially sanctioned books that come out about the CIA, like Legacy of Ashes by a New York Times reporter, which it purports to be talking about CIA follies, but has only a paragraph about one of the most important topics of all, which is the CIA's relationship to the drug traffic. So I would say Drugs, Oil, and War for people interested in the world approach, and The Road to 9/11, and eventually The Road to Afghanistan for those who are more interested in looking at America.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to that, and I'm sure many of my viewers are as well. So I also understand that you'll be speaking at a conference called Understanding Deep Politics that's coming up soon. Can you tell people when and where that will be?
Well, it's going to be in Santa Cruz, California, on the weekend of May 15th and 16th. And a number of people will be there, myself and Barry Zwicker from Canada, Annie Machon from England. I don't have the full list in front of me, but if you Google for Understanding Deep Politics, they have a very good website and make it easy with full of directions how to get there and everything else.
That's right. Well, Peter Dale Scott, you are a very busy man, so thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.